Thank you very much. I want to express a special thanks to a longtime and good friend, our good friend Sterling Tucker. I just got a note that says, Sterling, that gives me the time that I have to quit so that you are in good shape. Sterling and I were visiting up here, and he said, now I have another panel this afternoon, Senator Humphrey, and I said, so I have a vote too. And we have a vote in the Senate on legal services, which I know you have an interest in. And we are going to succeed in our effort today to maintain the legal services for our disadvantaged people. Let me quickly say just a word of greetings to the International Association of Official Human Rights or Human Rights Agencies, and particularly to you, Vivian, the lovely president, and to all of the officers. And I shall forego any further amenities because of time. I want to talk to you very seriously about your work. And your work and my work, I think, are really parallel and companion activities. The agencies and the official bodies that you represent are charged with the most important duty and function of government, namely to safeguard human rights. I think it's important to note that the first two charges in the preamble of the Constitution of the United States are right at the very heart of everything that you're working for in your official capacities. The first charge is to form a more perfect union, trying somehow or another to bring together the many parts and peoples of this great republic. The second charge is to establish justice. And that, of course, is the highest order of political work or of political statesmanship. But those two immediate charges in the preamble of the Constitution tell us the priorities that we need to have in this nation. Now, there are others, of course, to assure domestic tranquility, which means a harmony in our lives based upon mutual respect and human dignity. Not the tranquility that's forced by brute force, but the tranquility that comes from harmonious relationships based upon mutual respect. Surely to provide for the common defense, not only against external enemies, but the enemies even within. And some of those enemies are not physical. They are enemies of spirit, of fear, of hate, of discrimination, of prejudice. And then the great charge in the preamble to the Constitution to promote the general welfare and to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. I mention these things because they're so much taken for granted. And yet, if you stop and think about it just for a few moments, those few precious lines of that great document that is at the foundation of this republic tell us much of what we need to know and the philosophy that needs to guide us. The first three words, we the people, not we the government, not we some selected group of people, but just we the people. The whole concept of popular sovereignty. And then the charges that are made to the government. And every word in that preamble is a positive word, no neutrality. The words, for example, to form, to establish, to provide, to promote, to assure, to secure. Every one of those are action words, every one. And I would say that it places a special responsibility. The preamble of the Constitution places a special responsibility upon people in governmental bodies, in executive offices, in agencies, in legislatures, in Congress, in mayor's offices, in city councils, and county commissions, a special responsibility to achieve these established and well enunciated and articulated goals of this country, the goals of forming a more perfect union, of establishing justice, assuring domestic tranquility, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare, and securing the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. And then those founding fathers, as they are called, put it all in the present tense. because it said, we do hereby establish and ordain this Constitution. We do, this hour, this afternoon, here in Washington, D.C., wherever we meet, not in Philadelphia in 1789, but in the present tense. Now, with that as a philosophical base, let me discuss with you some of the things that are of concern to me. The first thing is we must never slacken our efforts in this struggle for human rights. There is no way to coast, nor can you ever afford to look back. You must look ahead, and you must recognize that the achievements that we have made thus far are but beginnings. And indeed, the whole story of democracy is very much a series of beginnings, leaving work to do for others yet to come. But the work that you have undertaken and to which you are now officially assigned is a great and noble work, and it requires the best of you. There can be no sense of satisfaction, but always a sense of urgency and even of some discontent. I happen to believe that a society that has a degree of tension within it is alive. If it gets too comfortable, people tend to become apathetic. We cannot afford to be either apathetic or indifferent, or as Franklin Roosevelt put it once, to be frozen in our indifference. And I sense that sometimes there is that attitude that permeates our country these days. So I come here to speak very, very candidly to you about human rights in America, telling you that it is the greatest challenge that faces us. There is no security in any country that is divided. There can be no second-class citizenship. There can only be one kind, and that's first-class citizenship. And we cannot afford the luxury or the pain of discrimination on the basis of race, or of sex, or age, or religion, or creed, or national origin. And yet you and I know that we've had it, and we've had large doses of it. And I think it's fair to say that you cannot accept the proposition that most Americans believe that two centuries of racial injustice has somehow vanished, or that other forms of discrimination have been eradicated. All that you can accept at this point is that we've made a start, and we must not permit a retreat. So we have a very heavy responsibility. The struggle to eradicate these living denials of justice and freedom continues, and that ought to be enough incentive for us to buckle down and do a job. Now, it's fashionable in some circles today to suggest that white politicians no longer have much to offer in this struggle for human rights, that it's only the blacks and the Chicanos, the Puerto Ricans, the Indians, and the women who have now taken over, and that the full burden of organizing the political forces to end racial abuses that offend us all is theirs. I disagree with that. While it's certainly true that a great deal of the responsibility has shifted to those who personally suffer under these wrongs, I flatly reject the notion that this burden is theirs alone. In other words, I'm not going to let anybody cop out. I do so for two reasons. First, I still believe that racial injustice and prejudice is as much a white problem as it is a black, brown, or red problem. And that if it is so, I am unable to understand how the problem can ever be solved without the full and active participation by whites, and particularly by public officials and private citizens alike. Second, real progress will be achieved only when the overwhelming majority of Americans are committed to action and are prepared to communicate this message to their elected representatives in every level of government. You know, we can look back at the civil rights battles of the 50s and the 60s with a certain air of nostalgia. In fact, on July 3rd of this year, we celebrated the 10th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I was in the forefront of that battle, as every one of you know. I was privileged to be the floor manager in one of the great legislative struggles of all times. We're well aware, for example, that there were certain things that were accomplished in the Civil Rights Act of 1957. But I think we have to realize that it was but a beginning. We have to also keep in mind that none of this has ever been easy. After the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1957, These initial steps were insufficient for the remaining problems of the 60s. And what were those problems as we saw them then? They were much more easily definable than they are even today. Equal job opportunities, equal access to public accommodations, greater protection of the right to vote, and the non-discriminatory use of federal funds. And yet to achieve those goals was a monumental task, and we ought never to underestimate it. And let me say, of all of those goals, that Voting Rights Act of 1965, I think, was one of the truly great pieces of legislation. It changed the politics of America, and is changing it every day. Because when people were denied the right to vote, why, by whatever process that right was denied, they were literally made second-class citizens or even denied the essentials of their citizenship. And that Voting Rights Act changed things and changed it all for the good. The legislative outlook in the early 1960s, and I can talk to you about it because many of you know that I've been in this struggle as a legislator all of my life. Starting as mayor of Minneapolis, I should quickly say that the very first conference that your association had, my city of Minneapolis was associated. We were associated with that first four-state group. So we've been a part of it. We had one of the first mayors, one of the first human relations councils or commissions in the United States. We had the first Fair Employment Practices Ordinance with enforceable powers in the United States. My friend Bill Leland is here amongst us here that worked with me in those days. And we had a great deal that was going on in the Twin Cities, particularly in Minneapolis, and then it spread to our sister city of St. Paul. Mr. Richardson's here of our own Civil Rights Commission in the state of Minnesota. We were one of the first states, one of the first nine states in the Union to pass basic civil rights law at a state level. And we are committed as a people in my state to it. But it wasn't an easy job. It was difficult. And then I look back at the 1960s, I must say that it looked all very, very difficult for us to do anything. The outlook in Congress was grim, despite the early efforts of 57. Our eventual triumph was not preordained. At numerous points in the 75-day battle to break the filibuster, and by the way, it was the first filibuster we were able to break since 1917. During that time, there were many times that people wanted us to compromise, but we refused to do it. And much of what happened during that time was due to political strategy that was worked out carefully. I don't have the time here today to tell you how we worked out teams of senators to take on every issue in that long and that complicated piece of legislation. It was one of the great moments, as I said, of legislative life. But what I'm getting to, without going over the past, is that it was but a beginning. And that law is no better than its enforcement. And the enforcement is no better than its implementation. We not only want to enforce civil rights laws, what we want to do is to bring about a sufficient respect for the law so that people observe it. And it's the observance of the law all through the entire society that's so essential. To be sure, we've been able in the governmental structures, federal, state, and local, to establish enforcement agencies. But what is needed is a spiritual rebirth in this country of the acceptance of one another as equals. It really requires a spiritual understanding as well as the legalities of the law. And it requires a deep sense of dedication and enthusiasm, standing up for what you believe to be right in these human relations that we talk about so much. Now, well, how are we going to move ahead? Because the truth is, we've been, at best, treading water, at best, holding on. This country is without direction today in practically every area, and you and I know it. Whatever its reason, Watergate, whatever it may be, but the country today is literally drifting. Our economic policies tell us this, or the condition of our economy. Even the admission this morning in the great press of America that we have been in a recession. Folks that you and I know could have told people about that a long time ago. The admission that we have double-digit inflation, which you and I know doesn't tell the story at all. Because inflation upon the poor, inflation upon the working people of this country is not 10.7, but 25 and 30%. Because they have to buy just the essentials. Food costs, rent, clothing, medical care, the things that they desperately need, those things have skyrocketed. So that these general averages that we get out of Washington sometimes do not apply at all to what is really happening to people as individuals. I'm here to ask us to develop a strategy now to forward the cause of human rights. Just like we had to develop a strategy in 1964 to beat down those that wanted to filibuster and to stop the Civil Rights Act of 64. We worked out a strategy. We stuck with it. It was hard business. I remember my son coming down with cancer in the last week of that debate and not being able to go home to see him when he was operated upon. And the unbelievable pain and suffering that went through me as an individual. But there was a job to do, and we had a strategy, and we had our tactics worked out, and we did the job. But now we have to think about how we forward beyond the law, how we go, in other words, further than the legalities, how we are able to permeate the whole political social structure of this country with the concept of equal rights, of human rights, of civil rights, of civil liberties, of equal protection under the law, and equal opportunity under the law. And it ought not to be difficult, because these things should seem so obvious to us. Well, let's see now if we can do something. I think it will avail us little or nothing to beat our chests in righteous indignation with a sense of moral consciousness about the inequities and injustices unless we have a program of action. This lesson is as true today as it was 20 years ago. And between the two extremes of moral consciousness and premeditated violence and intimidation lies a field for constructive political action. Now, we often hear people say that the national constituency in support of continued progress in the fields of human rights has vanished. I disagree with that. I happen to believe that despite the fact that we have been barely holding on and not making any progress of late, or not much progress of late, that there is a way to change it. We now are in a peculiar but vitally important period of our national life, when our lack of direction in the civil rights arena is no greater than the lack of direction generally. The American people and their elected leaders are confused and ambivalent about where we should be heading as a nation, and they are divided about our long-range and short-range objectives. Goals and priorities are literally untabulated and unknown. And I think what this nation needs is the listing out of some goals, some great challenges. I sense a hunger amongst people to do good things. I think people today are just literally looking to the heavens for leadership. And they know the importance of it. They want someone to literally make the clarion call, to tell them to do better, not to be perfect, because we're not, but to do better. If I could just pick out one phrase for us, it is that we pledge ourselves to do better, knowing that we're fallible, knowing that we're human, knowing that we're limited. But if we could only make up our mind that tomorrow can be a better day, if we can get people off this business about the past, about which we can do little or nothing, and even to tell people that the current events are not the main issue. It's where we're going, not where we've been, or not even where we are. Well, dear friends, I think it's within our power to break this impasse, and that's why I'm here. I don't know whether I can be of any help in changing the immediate course in our country, but that within itself is not the whole question. I'll put it bluntly to you. Between now and 1976, the next presidential election, your organization and people dedicated to the cause of human rights must wage a relentless battle to impress upon political leadership in this country the urgent necessity of forward advance in this field, that there can be no turning back, that you can't compromise away people's rights. I would hope that we might even be able to influence this president to realize the opportunity that he has, because he's there. And that office must be used for moral persuasion. But whether we can do that or not, the important thing is that as a Republican or as a Democrat or whatever your political persuasion, that you wage a relentless struggle to inform and to educate, to cajole and to persuade the political leadership of these political parties to stand steadfast in the field of human rights and to move forward with an affirmative plan of action. Presidents never operate in a vacuum, no matter how much they seek to seal themselves off from public opinion. So therefore, I propose that we devise a political strategy that will assist, yes, insist, and propel the president and the next president to make this kind of affirmative decision in this cause of human rights. And there's good historical precedent for it. I can tell you, as one that's been close to a couple of presidents, that even with the great President Kennedy, it was the Civil Rights Leadership Conference that pressed upon him and pressed upon the cabinet and pressed upon the Congress that more had to be done than the original legislative initiatives that were handed down to the Congress. The original civil rights proposals that were handed down to the Congress were not enough. And we had to change those. We had to strengthen those in 1963-64. And it was because of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights that represented such a broad cross-section of this country that we were able to bring pressure to bear, that we were able to inform, that we were able to persuade. So we have to devise a strategy. I contend that the entire concept of the civil rights movement must be broadened to include the rights and opportunities that should be more available to all disadvantaged groups in America, not just to blacks, not just to browns or reds or Indians or Puerto Ricans or Chicanos or blacks or women, but all people. Now let me just lay it out. I'm thinking about the physically handicapped. I'm thinking about the mentally retarded who are discriminated against the most cruel and inhumane ways, about the elderly who are frequently locked up in old people's homes or in nursing homes and oftentimes forgotten and isolated. All these people must face many of the same barriers and misunderstandings and prejudices that confronts people who are discriminated against because of their race or their national origin. Injustice knows no race. It knows no age. It knows no sex. We're also in a period where the issue of women's rights and women's political power must be included in the broad definition of civil rights. As I see it, we must identify the struggle for civil rights as an all-embracing struggle for the rights and privileges and duties of all Americans. In the political arena, there are not enough blacks, and listen well to this. In the political arena where votes count, the first law of politics is to be able to count. The second one, they say, is to be able to divide. But the first one is to be able to count and to add. So in the political arena, let me lay it on the line. There are not enough blacks. There are not enough Chicanos. There are not enough Indians. There are not enough Puerto Ricans to form an electoral majority. Therefore, we must create a climate of identity of interest between the needs, the hopes, and the fears of the minorities and the needs and the hopes and the fears of the majority. And that's not too difficult if we just lift our eyes. In simple language, this means identifying the cause of human rights and civil rights with good education for all of our children. Millions of parents, white and black, feel that the present educational system is not satisfying the needs of their children. We must identify civil rights with the right of every American to good health care. It is not only the blacks and the Chicanos and the Indians that have inadequate health care. There are millions of Americans, whites, poor and middle income, as well as black or brown or red, who are either the victims of inadequate health care or unable to pay for what care is available. We must find some new common denominators, mutual needs, mutual wants, common hopes and fears, and we must use them to bind together a great coalition of people representing the hopes and the fears of the majority. Out of this great coalition, we can fashion a new Bill of Rights that will belong to all Americans, and because it does, it will have tremendous force and power. And I speak to you now about that new Bill of Rights. The right to a meaningful life free from poverty that affects all people. There are more whites in poverty than there are blacks. And we have got to unite the people today who are the victims of poverty and let them know that there is a way out of this bondage. Break those chains of poverty. Oh, I could cry out here in Washington when I see the lessening of our efforts in this war on poverty. You know, they say that our war on poverty didn't work. I'll tell you why. We never ever gave it the tools, the ammunition. Had we ever put as much into the war on poverty as we put into the war in Vietnam or Korea or anything else, or even the modern defense budget, we would have won that war. But there were millions more involved. Millions more. So we made a few mistakes. Dear friends, we make mistakes in the Pentagon that make the mistakes of the war on poverty seem insignificant. You know, we just haven't made up our mind what we want to do. We have people today that even want to abandon some of our effort in the war on cancer because they said some of the experiments aren't working. But one day it will. And we have to have the courage to stick with it. We have to have the right to full and equal protection of the law. All people today find that justice delayed is justice denied. The people who live in the ghetto are the victims of crime much more than the people who live in the suburbs. But all people, I say, have the right to equal protection of the law. And as I travel around this country, I see how cities and city governments and county governments ignore the basic human services that are required for decent living in these neighborhoods. There is no reason for a ghetto to be dirty in a slum. No reason at all. And you've got to become angry about it. There's no reason for Americans to tolerate obsolete, dilapidated housing, rat-infested back alleys and neighborhoods. No reason. And the civil rights movement today is not just looking at somebody and finding out that they're of a different color and say, I want to do something for you. But it's looking at a person and seeing whether or not they have a chance to make something out of their life, to live under equal protection of the law with a government that cares about them. That's what it's all about. The right to productive and gainful employment. Unemployment knows no race. It stands as a constant threat to the life and well-being of millions of families. Do you know what this economic policy of these past years has cost us in this country? $550 billion in lost gross national product. $135 billion in lost federal revenues. Look at what we could have done with 130 some mid billions of dollars in America. We've got people today that are worried about what they call the rising prices, as I am. But I'm also worrying about the slack in our economy. The fact that we've lost billions and billions and billions of dollars of productive time because we've let people be unemployed. I believe that those that want work should have an opportunity to work at a good wage and salary under good working conditions. And if the private sector of America can't provide it, then it is the duty of a government of the people and by the people and for the people to provide it. Give people something to do. The right to economic, political, and social opportunity free from the obstruction of discrimination based on race, creed, and sex we've talked about. But it is a right. It's not just something we talk about. It's like a new member, it's a new article in the Bill of Rights. The right to move up the social structure, not just the right to a job, but the right to be a manager, a supervisor, the right to serve on a board of directors. Not only the right, but the realization of that right. The right to a clean and decent neighborhoods, as I've mentioned here a moment ago. Oh, this city of Washington, from the days of 1967 and 68, when sections of this city went up in flames, and commitments by two presidents that we were going to do something about it. And there, go up there and see on 14th and see what it's like. Go and see. And ladies and gentlemen, you know I believe in foreign assistance. I have helped as a senator to design many of these programs. But I'm here to tell you that if we can loan money to the Soviet Union under the Export-Import Bank at 6% and 7%, if we can have loans for people all over the world that we've never met, if we can have grants of money for people that we'll never see, Tell me why we can't have loans and grants under equal terms for people that are our neighbors right here. Yes, another right, the right to be free from violence and terrorism, the right to privacy, free from official or private invasion, these snoopers, these wiretappers. I want to tell you, I've got to be careful. I'll have to have expletive deleted here if I go on. There's nothing that irritates me more than to feel that there is no privacy left. People have a right to that, the right to safety and